Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa, and today I'm joined by Stephanie, Linda, Heather, Nicola and Pat.
Hello! Hello.
And in a departure from our usual programme, today we have a guest presenter right here in the studio with us. And that is Alison Robertson. Hi, Alison.
Hi.
Alison, you may remember, won our short story competition last year. And she was a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Central Lancashire. She also has written two as yet unpublished novels, one of which I'm very much enjoying reading at the moment, and embarked on a third. Alison is going to be helping us later in the show with the concept of foreshadowing. And if you hear any panting in the background, it's not Alison. We've got Will Finn with us again today. Nicola will be sharing her work in progress and getting some feedback. Heather and Alison will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. And Stephanie, well, I don't know what Stephanie's doing. She's being a bit mysterious about it. But first of all, Linda will ask us to
name the novel.
Yes, I'm going to do that. And we'll see who can get it. Okay, first clue. Published in English for the first time in 1946, the author of this novel was a French philosopher whose views contributed to the rise of the philosophy known as absurdism. He once wrote that his whole life was devoted to opposing the philosophy of nihilism while still delving deeply into individual freedom. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1957.
Ooh. No idea.
Well, I've got an idea of the author, but...
An inkling.
Alison's got an inkling.
A couple of possibilities.
Yeah. Inklings, ideas and possibilities. Okay.
Okay.
Next clue. The first-person narrator commits a murder, not out of revenge, he says, but because of the disorienting heat and vexing brightness of the sun, which blinds him as it reflects off the knife.
Oh, I should know. Ooh. I think I know what this is.
Ooh.
It's one of two.
Okay.
Mm. I've written a name, but yeah.
Okay, we have somebody who thinks they know.
And, not okay. The book.
No. Third clue. The novel is famous for its first line. Mother died today, or maybe it was yesterday, I don't know.
Come on, Alison. Anybody else before Alison tells us what it is?
I may be wrong, but is it The Outsider by Camus?
Not quite.
I thought it was Camus.
It is Camus.
The Albert.
It is Camus.
The Plague is different. Is where they're cut
it's
off.
The Stranger.
Oh, but it's the same. Yes, L'Étranger.
L'Étranger.
You were right. It's just a different translation.
Yeah. Oh, is it? Oh,
Alison, yeah.
That's amazing.
I think it's in L'Étranger in... bad French.
Okay.
Could be translated as The Stranger or the Outsider.
The cover is published as
The Outsider. Is it? Okay.
Well done, Alison.
The Stranger. Albert Camus. Or
Camus.
Marvellous.
Okay. And did you know he was also a goalkeeper?
A goalkeeper? No, I did not know that. I knew he was also a journalist.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if he played for Algeria, but he was definitely a goalkeeper, a football player.
Clever man, then.
I say definitely, I may have just made it up. Well, thank you, Linda. So, Nicola, we've got a bit more Brian, which we haven't had for a while, haven't we?
And I wrote this to order because I've had a very clumsy attempt at foreshadowing in this as well.
Oh, very
taking
good.
Taking the theme into account. Are you ready?
Mm. Mm.
Even from the dining hall, the noise was pretty impressive. Any new visitor to the village would think someone was certainly being murdered further inside the keep. Everyone in the dining hall was ignoring it, looking shifty and uncomfortable. Nobody was lingering once they'd eaten their fill, filling urgent errands elsewhere. As the latest cry rose to a climax, Brienne half stood, waiting for a minute, then sank back down on the hard wooden bench and swallowed the final spoonful of her yoghurt and berries. She reached for one of the delicious filled flatbreads and started in on that. "Shouldn't you be going in there?" said Adonis, who sat at the end of the table along with the rest of the warriors. "Not yet. They said they would call me when the time was getting nearer and contractions more frequent." Brienne knew from her studies at the villa that these were only the early stages of labour, and that, when labour got going, there would be no time for food or rest. She needed to save her strength too. "Is it always like this?" "This loud, everyone pretending nothing's happening but so on edge." He lifted one eyebrow at her, shovelling down a flatbread filled with a mixture of cold meats and marinated peppers. "Yes, although these are special circumstances because it's the chieftain's first baby and very precious. His temper is a bit short, so that's adding to the tension. Haven't you been around a baby being born before?" she asked. "No, this is my first time out travelling with you, remember, and back at home we're usually sent off hunting when the time comes for one of the women to give birth. Gets us out of the way," he laughed. "There's hours to go yet, and then it will take hours to happen. I think I'll go for a quick walk while I still can. I'll just go down the track a bit, but I'll stay within shouting distance of here if someone comes and gets me if anything changes." Brienne walked out into the sunshine and breathed in the clear early morning air. The food was delicious here, but the dining room was rather dark, and not everyone made full use of the bathhouses. Chickens roamed freely around the village and in and out of the huts and the keep, adding to the din, smells and general muck underfoot. The air was clean, a slight breeze shivered the olive leaves. The sky was very blue, the sun shining through the trees and dappling the rough track down the hill. She ambled along on the grass verge, looking over the fences at the goats and sheep the tribe kept to feed everyone. She was standing under an olive tree, leaning against a trunk, feeding grass to three baby goats, when a rider galloped up the rough track. He was riding a horse, not a donkey, and dressed in dark colours, a full-length cape thrown back over his shoulders, showing a long-sleeved shirt, leather jerkin, and rough-wool trousers tucked into long boots. As he rode past, his gaze slid over her, half hidden beneath the tree, and she felt chilled as if the sun had disappeared behind a cloud for a moment. "Not your typical Greek warrior, more like someone from Northern Europe. He must be hot in all those clothes," Brienne thought, watching him pull up in front of the keep. The stranger slid off his horse, threw the reins to the man standing picking his teeth with a straw, and strode towards the keep. Elias the chieftain came out to meet him, and they disappeared together around the back of the homestead and down the hill towards the path to the temple. "Brienne, come now!" Adonis was shouting for her from the doorway, so she returned to the keep, wondering who the stranger could be.
Mm-hmm. And so am I wondering who the stranger could be.
No, I think the foreshadowing is the flatbreads.
Sorry?
What?
The flatbread.
What?
I don't know, he's a foreign origin.
No. No. Or maybe. Sorry, that's a bit. I think as he rode past, his gaze slid over her, half hidden behind the tree, and she felt chilled, as if the sun had disappeared behind a cloud for a moment. Mm. Was foreshadowing.
That was my clumsy attempt at it. Yes.
I've put good foreshadowing.
That is. Yeah.
What the flatbreads has done is created a false foreshadowing for Stephanie, where she thinks that something is important.
I can understand why they were eating flatbreads after the yogurt and berries.
And they were mentioned twice.
Yeah. Yes, it's the chewing gum on the mantelpiece. Yeah. We'll come to that later when we do foreshadowing.
I think the foreshadowing works really well. Most of us got it.
Right.
I'd quite like to say something about the opening, if that's okay.
Oh, absolutely.
So in the opening, you've got quite a number of uncertain words, which are quite vague. So pretty impressive, any new visitor, someone, certainly, everyone, nobody. And I think that doesn't have impact that it could have if you made it a little bit more specific. It lacks specificity. I can't usually say that. But so I think it might be better to start something more directly. So, for example, you could have across from the dining hall the screams of a woman, or name her, or the chieftain's woman in labour tore the afternoon apart. Something really that has impact, because it's all a little bit vague at that beginning, whereas the thing is the labour, isn't it? You know, but unless it's important that you deflect from that or defer it, that the labour, then I think you'd perhaps be better just starting straight in with it.
Okay.
Because everyone, no one, nobody, certainly pretty. It's all a little bit vague when actually the scene itself is quite dramatic.
Mm. Mm. Thank you. Mm. It's funny, I highlighted pretty and certainly, and but I couldn't have explained it quite as well as Alison just did.
I just thought certainly was superfluous
and pretty as well.
Now we know why.
Yeah.
The noise was impressive.
Yeah.
Mm. And I also marked down here, she reached for one of the delicious filled flatbreads and started in on that. I didn't like the phrase started in on that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I must have been quite hungry when I wrote this.
I think so. Yeah. But I don't know what else you could say. And began to eat or something. Mm-hmm. But she's already eating.
Or tore it apart or something.
Yeah, something.
You know. If you include something like tore apart, it kind of creates a kind of metaphor for the labour that's going
on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like it.
I thought this bit where the man is asking, is it always like this? And I said, yep. So,
I mean, along with certainly, I think when you talk about the delicious flatbreads, delicious is one of those words like when you say the scenery was amazing. Yeah. It doesn't really tell you anything. I mean, I'm being picky, but I think,
I think I had one of them eating flatbreads and I had a brainstorm and got the other one to be, so it seemed too many flatbread. Much flatbread action going on.
Well, the flatbreads, I started to think, why has she mentioned flatbreads twice? Oh, they're poisonous.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Because they were mentioned twice in two different contexts.
What I mean about the chewing gum on the mantelpiece, this is from, you know, that very funny book, How Not to Write a Novel.
Yeah.
And
I have read.
Yes. We've all read it, but we all still do these things. But if somebody walks over and sticks a piece of chewing gum on the mantelpiece, the reader is waiting for significance of that. Yeah. Why have they done that? What's going to happen with the
chewing gum? I shall talk about that later.
It was interesting this because as I wrote it, when I came back to get a piece of work in progress, there was an entire couple of scenes that I'd imagined in my head that I hadn't yet written. I was quite astonished to find I hadn't written them because they were so clear in my head. So
you thought you'd done it.
So that got me going on the writing again because I've been thinking about it.
A couple of things. When she's describing labour to Adonis, and she says, and the contractions get more frequent. It's a bit technical and a bit modern. I mean, I know she is a modern person who's been transported back there, but I thought there might be another way, you know, like the pains are getting closer together or something like that, a little bit less technical. And I slightly didn't like he lifted one eyebrow at her because I just found it was implying quizzical rather than anxious, or maybe that was what you meant to it, but it was a slightly odd. Mm. It struck me odd. I don't know how other people felt. Mm.
I didn't think that it struck me as being like, oh, gosh, is it always like this? You know, a little exasperated, or a little, like, amused kind of thing, but with the eyebrow raised. I can't raise my eyebrow to show you that. But
that's all that Botox.
Must be.
Girlfriends.
And you probably noticed some repetition when you were reading it. That always happens, doesn't it?
Clean sky.
In the dining hall, in the dining hall. Yeah. Rough track.
Air, sunshine, sunshining. Yeah.
Hours and hours.
Yeah. Slid.
But I enjoyed the humorous tone of the piece.
Yes.
But I did feel the dialogue was a little bit stilted to me. But that's okay. It's a first draft and, you know, you can make that a bit more.
I'm just glad to be writing again.
Yes, I'm glad to have Brienne back in the picture again. I was concerned that Brienne wasn't coming back for a while, and I like Brienne.
I was a bit confused, though. And I just found I couldn't sort of place this, and I just felt I was...
Because of the words I was using, like keep, homestead, that sort of stuff, was struggling with that.
Just didn't seem to fit with anything else.
Maybe you weren't last we had this as work in progress because Brianna's been transported back in time and she's in
more
the foothills of the
Taygetos
Mountains in southern Greece.
Oh,
and
there you
she's
go.
inhabiting the body of a midwife. But you don't remember Hairy Toes?
No.
You probably missed that, but she's very surprised to be in this body with the unshaved
toes.
Legs and hairy toes.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That follows the donkey.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, it makes more sense.
Okay.
Yeah, and his gaze slid over her half hidden behind the tree.
Yes, I got that.
His gaze wasn't half hidden behind the tree, was it?
Yeah, it was.
She was half hidden behind the tree.
Yeah.
Rephrase it.
I'm saying
I would say as he rode past, his gaze slid over her full stop.
Okay.
She was hiding behind the tree.
Half hidden behind the tree. Or
she felt
the
chill.
She ducked back behind the tree or something.
Because that's the important foreshadowing bit, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of things which are to do with when you're first writing, you tend to put a lot of information in that then can come out again. And I think there are a couple of examples of this. So when you talk about when she walks out of into the clear morning air, the food was delicious, the dining room was dark, not everyone made full use of the bathhouses, chickens roamed in and out. Instead of creating a kind of atmosphere where the chickens bit I think is good, but all the other stuff about the dining room and the bathhouses seems not to quite fit there because she's in the moment of walking in the sunshine. So I think you could probably leave that out. And then when you describe the man as well, there were a couple of things there. He was riding a horse, not a donkey, which I thought you perhaps meant riding a horse rather than a donkey, whereas most people would be riding a donkey there. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Riding a horse, not a donkey. And then you describe his dress in quite detail, and maybe I think that would be quite a lot for her to take in such a short space of
time. As he galloped past.
So, I think the cape thrown over the shoulders is always a kind of give away to some character, isn't it, that he's wearing this cape. But I don't think you need quite that detail.
Yeah, the main thing is the contrast with the local mode of dress.
Yes, the local mode. And there was one last thing, which I'm not sure is a thing or not, but when you say grass verge to me suggests the cutting of grass with the machine.
Yes.
And I wondered if
it as was I read it, I thought that's not
well, verge just is an edge, isn't it?
It
could be the edge of the track. I'm not sure. It didn't suggest that to me.
No,
I know,
and it can go back because you have the verger, don't you?
Yeah,
in the church.
It
was perhaps to look after the vergers.
But it's. There's not many verges in Greece, though, is there, when you think about it?
It didn't just seem to stick out a little bit.
It's the shoulder of the road, we say. Yeah. You could say the side of
but if you use words like edge, that actually suggests an edginess or a kind of sense of something being on the edge of something as well. So sometimes you can use words that have a
which adds to your foreshadowing.
Adds to the foreshadowing.
Oh. Thank you.
Well, thank you for giving this to us, and I thank you for bringing Brianne back.
And I'd certainly read on as well, so I think your foreshadowing worked. I want to know who this man is.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you, ladies. Thank you.
Well done. Thanks for sharing, Nicola. Stephanie, what are you up to?
Well, I sent you, Teresa, a note earlier this week saying, I can't say what I'm doing, but it's about a word which until now was not part of my vocabulary.
Yes, you did.
Okay, well, I shall now explain.
Oh, good.
I was rapidly running out of things to talk about in this part of our transmission until I found an unfamiliar word, a word not until that day part of my vocabulary. You may not ask what it is, but I shall impart that information now, as by now you must find my pick of words confusing or awkward. Can you spot my omission? That word of which I was ignorant is lipogram. And I want to discuss lipogrammatic writing, writing which lacks a particular symbol. In this paragraph, that, most known as the fifth in our rank of script, found amid D and E, which sounds similar to the sound in quinoa, must stay unsaid. What is it?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
You've completely lost it. Is it a silent letter?
Diphthong.
Like the U in quinoa.
Or in labour or colour.
In this paragraph, that most known as the fifth in our rank of script, found amid D and F, which sounds similar to the sound in quinoa, all of that entire paragraph and my email to you had no E's in
there. Oh, really?
And that's
lipogrammatic writing.
Why?
And, well, it's from the ancient Greek, actually, lepogrammatos, meaning leaving out a letter.
Yes, grammar is a letter and lipo is missing, absent. Yeah.
So it's constrained writing or a word game consisting of writing paragraphs or longer works in which you avoid a particular letter or group of letters. So in the early days, the reason I guess it's named after ancient Greeks, the ancient Greeks used to avoid putting the sigma in ancient texts. God only knows why. So I thought I'll have some fun and I'll try and write something. It's very, very difficult to write something without using a letter.
It sounded like you were quoting from someone like Chaucer or Dickens or something.
No,
But didn't you not at one point say the word thee?
No.
You sure?
I was rapidly running out of things to talk about in this part of our transmission until I found an unfamiliar word, a word not until that day part of my account. You may not ask what it is, but I shall impart that information now. As you must by now find my pick of words confusing or awkward, can you spot my omission? This word of which I was ignorant is lipogram. You look, there's absolutely no ease in that.
And, Linda, I took the liberty of recording this conversation. We can check.
All right. Good.
So I just thought I'd share that with you because I was running out of things and I came across it and
didn't
was fascinated.
Somebody write a whole novel?
Yes, they did.
Without the
Ernest
letter E?
Vincent Wright wrote Gadsby in 1939, which is 50,000 words without the single letter E.
Oh, my God.
So is it always the letter E?
No, you can choose. So, for example, if you look at Poe's poem, The Raven, there's no Z in it, but whether that was a lipogrammatic poem or not.
You think Z's.
I mean, it's easy not to write with Z's, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unless you're American, of course, and then you can't organise anything. Or...
That's right. We organise things with a much sharper eyebrow or a knife.
So he wrote 50,000 words without the letter E. So it's things like he couldn't use any verbs that ended in ED and he couldn't use plurals with ES and things like that.
And so, Stephanie, why are you telling us this?
Because I thought it was really interesting and amusing.
It is interesting, but also, why would you do that to yourself? It's hard enough writing a novel.
I know.
I was just thinking, what a gripping read it probably isn't.
Yeah, well,
it probably isn't.
There's actually quite a lot
you're
of...
ease.
Maybe you need a few E's to get through it.
The guy that wrote that book actually taped the typewriter, the E key on his typewriter, and taped it down so he couldn't use it. And apparently he was motivated, according to Wikipedia, he was motivated to write it by reading a lipogrammatic poem by another author. There was a Spanish playwright who wrote five short stories, each omitting one vowel, because obviously in Spanish, the letter A is the most commonly used letter, whereas in English it's E. That's why lipogrammatically you probably start with the most difficult.
Mm.
In 1986, The Book of Nothing, Cipher and Poverty by Mike Schertzer is presented as the writings of a prisoner whose world has been impoverished to a single utterance, who can find me here in this silence. And he writes poems that use only the vowels A, E, I and O and consonants C, D, F, H, L, M, N, R, S, T. So he limits himself to a number. So, you know, it's none of us are going to do it, but I just thought it was a bit of fun. And
it is.
But I used to have on my computer keyboard the K was stuck. And so like you'd press it and nothing would happen. You'd press and press and press. So maybe that would also lead you to write a lipogram if you had a dodgy keyboard. You might just have to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what happened to me at one point with a computer a couple of computers ago, my N key wore out. The N.
Yeah.
I could not use the
letter
N. Some
of them, they just do go,
And so I would put my finger there and I'd type the rest of the word, and there's just a space always where the N's should be. But it didn't bother me in reading because I knew what was missing.
Your brain put it in.
Yeah.
Yes, it did. But I'd like to ask you where you saw that letter. I mean, that word.
I think I just was looking at words about words and, you know, I went off down a rabbit hole on Google and came up with lipogram. Oh, and then I thought, I'm going to write one. Because obviously that's better than doing any creative writing, isn't it?
Yeah,
anything's better than doing any creative writing.
Brilliant, Stephanie. Thank you very much. Now it's over to our guest presenter, Alison Robertson.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about foreshadowing. We've already heard a little bit of foreshadowing in Nicola's story. So foreshadowing is a literary device that has a number of functions. Principally, it hints at, predicts, or suggests events that will happen in the future. However, not all foreshadowing in a story precedes events. Sometimes, as we will see, foreshadowing is in reverse, in that the hints and clues are given from a point in the future about something that is going to be revealed about the past. So foreshadowing is often a structural element in that it works backwards and forwards along a timeline. Types of this kind of foreshadowing that I'm going to discuss today are prophecy, prologue, epigraph, and pre-scene. Another function of foreshadowing is more subtle in that the device does not directly indicate events that are going to happen, but instead influences mood and atmosphere through the use of symbolism, imagery and metaphor. I'm going to start with two brief examples of foreshadowing. This is the first one, and I made this one up myself. When I got on the number 14 bus to the Victoria and Albert Museum, I had no idea that this short journey would change my life forever. The reader immediately wants to know what event happened to change the narrator's life and will want to read on to find out. The sentence is spoken by a narrator who has knowledge about unfolding events that the reader does not. She is speaking from a place in the future. I'm sure you'll agree, though, that this foreshadowing is not very subtle. We might call this direct foreshadowing. In the second quote, we read a different form of foreshadowing. The trunks of the trees, too, were dusty, and the leaves fell early that year, and we saw the troops marching along the road, and the dust rising, and leaves, stirred by the breeze, falling, and the soldiers marching, and afterward the road bare and white, except for the leaves. In this quote taken from Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, we don't know the year or where this is, but we know that something is going to happen and it will not be good. Of course, the soldiers marching hint at war, but it is the symbolism in the repeated imagery of the leaves that creates a more indirect and subtle sense of foreboding. After looking at two different examples of foreshadowing, one direct and one indirect, I'm now going to focus on types of the technique that foretell specific events in a novel. The first of these is prophecy. This is a very long-established way in which writers use foreshadowing. Here, the future is directly predicted, often by supernatural means. Good examples of this are Oedipus and Macbeth. Both of these prophecies tell of events to come, but in each case, the prophecy elicits complex responses from the eponymous characters. Oedipus tries to escape his fate, and Macbeth fails to realise that killing Duncan will be part of the unfolding story. Prophecy and fortune-telling would always add a supernatural element to a story, so I'd expect it to be limited to particular genres such as fantasy, although writers might explore other more contemporary forms of prophecy, such as DNA testing. My next examples don't use prophecy but involve some form of narrative intervention to point the reader to coming events. My first example of this is Wuthering Heights. In Chapter 3, the narrator Lockwood has visited Heathcliff for the second time at Wuthering Heights, and this time he gets snowed in and has to stay overnight. He finds Catherine's diary and reads it, giving the reader an insight into Catherine's character and her past. He then has a symbolic dream before waking up to Cathy's ghost tapping at the window. Lockwood is a frame narrator, piecing together the story as told to him by Nellie Dean, but this early scene gives Lockwood, and thus the reader, not just an insight into the events that unfold in the retelling, but a sense of mood and tone too. Frame narrators can be a useful way of foreshadowing. Another great example is Conan Doyle's The Adventure of the Speckled Band, where Holmes, as the frame narrator, gives some hints at what is to come in the following tale, and by doing so he whets our appetite for the story. He confides, "It is perhaps as well that the facts should now come to light, for I have reasons to know that there are widespread rumours as to the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott, which tend to make the matter even more terrible than the truth. As readers, we are intrigued about the rumours and the facts. If we are fans of the genre, we know we are in for a compelling detective story in which Holmes solves a case." Another more subtle example of a narrator foreshadowing is in The Catcher in the Rye, in which the narrator, Holden Caulfield, also controls the reader's knowledge of events. Here, Caulfield reveals a hint that, first of all, he's not going to tell us everything. None of that David Copperfield kind of crap, or my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. That alone is intriguing in itself, as a mission always makes us want to know why things are being left out. He goes on to say that he is going to tell us the madman stuff that happened to me before Christmas, just before I got pretty run down and had to come out and take it easy. The reader, intrigued by Caulfield's refusal to tell some things, knows that this is important. We want to know what all that madman stuff was and what happened. Another, usually more subtle way of playing with time is the use of a prologue. The prologue can often point to events to come, maybe from a different perspective or narrative point of view. Again, although the prologue comes structurally first, it can also be narrated from the future. Here's the opening of Donatart's Secret History, for example. The snow in the mountains was melting, and Bunny had been dead for several weeks before we came to understand the gravity of our situation. He'd been dead for 10 days before they found him. Like Wuthering Heights and Catcher in the Rye, Tart's prologue covers events after the main story of the book, so we begin the novel knowing that a murder has been committed and a group of friends are involved in Bunny's death. We want to read on and find out why and how the murder took place. You hear a lot about agents not liking the use of prologues, and readers often say they skip them. Prologues all too often end up as an info dump, or contain lots of explanations that help understand the world building. The key thing, like all the techniques I look at here, is that the foreshadowing device, whether that's prologue, prophecy, or narrative voice, has got to relate to the story and be a significant part of it. Of course, experimental fiction of all kinds will play with these rules, and you're free to do so. But if you're deliberately trying to foreshadow, then you must be careful what devices you use. Often, in discussion of foreshadowing, we are reminded of Anton Chekhov's famous advice. If in the first act you have hung a pistol on the wall, then in the following one it should be fired. Mm. The concept of Chekhov's gun is not that it is an actual gun, but something given significance by the writer, the chewing gum, for example. In this case, that element in the story must have some function later on. Again, much contemporary fiction may misdirect or confound the reader, but if your intention is to foreshadow, then you need to take care what you plant. Planting a gun and having it go off in the next scene may seem a bit too obvious, but foreshadowing can be multiple layered and complex, as my next example shows. This time it's not a prologue or a narrative intervention, but foreshadowing in the form of an epigraph, a short piece of poetry from Paradise Lost. Did I request thee, maker, from my clay to mould me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? This epigraph starts the novel Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, and of course a parallel is being made between the epic poem Paradise Lost by Milton and Frankenstein. As the novel progresses, the reader begins to understand the way the first biblical story of the fall of humankind prefigures, historically and symbolically, this second fall. Here, the reference or allusion to another text brings, through intertextuality, elements of philosophy, structural form, and mood. For example, Frankenstein is clearly a narrative of fall, a questioning of human hubris or pride. But also in this specific quote used, an argument from Victor, Dr. Frankenstein, who is a type of Adam, that he didn't ask to be born at all, didn't ask to be promoted to the highest level of being, and thus a challenge to God. God has made him this way, is the implication. In addition, the quote could be attributed to the monster. He too is a kind of Adam, moulded from clay by his god Victor, and not asking to be born either. Finally, it could be argued that as well as being a kind of Adam, the monster is also a type of Lucifer, expelled by his god Victor. It's a very complex and dense allusion, but it is a perfect form of foreshadowing of the events that unfold and the ideas the novel explores. Alluding to other texts, then, is a powerful way of prefiguring events, moods, or ideas in a novel. You do need to be sure, though, that if you use a quote, that you have copyright, that you have permission. My next example alludes to a text in its actual title, and this is another way of foreshadowing. In Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, the allusion is to Robert Burns' poem To a Mouse, which declares, "The best laid schemes are mice and men gang after glay." No one who knows that line can doubt that the novel is going to end well. In Of Mice and Men, Steinbeck employs a structural form of foreshadowing called a pre-scene, and it's where one event prepares symbolically for another. Incidentally, this happens a lot in the Bible in a form of foreshadowing called typology, where events in the New Testament are prefigured by events in the Old. For example, Jonah's 3 days in the whale prefigures Christ's death and resurrection. In a pre-scene, generally, the first event figures the next bigger one. The two events can be repeats of the same event, but with developing importance and significance, or they can be different events altogether. In Steinbeck's novel, a worker, Candy, owns a suffering old dog, but cannot bear to have him put down. When another worker, Carlson, shoots the dog, Candy is upset and realises that he should have shot the dog himself. Later, when George shoots his brother Lenny to stop Curly killing him, this is a more significant repeat of the first foreshadowing event. The novels I have used so far have all been examples of structural foreshadowing in which events are foretold, hinted at, or alluded to. However, As I said earlier, foreshadowing can also be used to play with and direct the reader's emotional response, creating a sense of foreboding and dread, or in rarer cases, eliciting a feeling of hope and fulfilment. My last and longer example is from Charles Dickens' wonderful ghost story, The Signal Man, written in 1866, which contains both recurring events and symbolic language. Here, Dickens creates a sense of dread through imagery, but also uses repetition to foreshadow the final horrific events of this masterly ghost story. If I was to pin this kind of foreshadowing down, I'd say it was pre-seen, with each repetition prefiguring the next, and each time adding another layer of inevitability that culminates in the final horror. The excess of foreshadowing here gives the story its uncanny effect, as does its use of the double, which I don't really have time to go into now, but is a very effective device. The Signalman is told from the point of view of an unnamed narrator who is visiting the area and who becomes interested in a signalman he sees down below on the railway tracks. The story begins as he is looking down a steep bank from where he shouts out to the railway worker and then observes his strange response. In this first extract, listen carefully to the body language of the narrator, as well as to what he says. I'm going to use my best acting now. Hello! Below there! When he heard a voice thus calling to him, he was standing at the door of his box with a flag in his hand furled round its short pole. One would have thought, considering the nature of the ground, that he could not have doubted from what quarter the voice came, but instead of looking up to where I stood on the top of the steep cutting nearly over his head, he turned himself about and looked down the line. There was something remarkable in his manner of doing so, though I could not have said for my life what. But I know it was remarkable enough to attract my notice, even though his figure was foreshortened and shadowed down in the deep trench, and mine was high above him, so steeped in the glow of an angry sunset that I had shaded my eyes with my hand before I saw him at all. Hello! Below! In this opening, we immediately feel that something is off. The railway man does not look up at the narrator, but down the line. Note too the pathetic fallacy, the angry sky. The narrator's call is important, as we shall see. But his actions, I had shaded my eyes with his hand before I saw him at all, is key to the story and foreshadows all that is to come. Having walked down the line, the narrator makes further observations about the signalman and his location, creating a sense of mood and tone. His post was in as solitary and dismal a place as ever I saw. On either side, a dripping, wet wall of jagged stone, excluding all view but a strip of sky. The perspective one way, only a crooked prolongation of this great dungeon. The shorter perspective in the other direction, terminating in a gloomy red light, and the gloomier entrance to a black tunnel, in whose massive architecture there was a barbarous, depressing, and forbidding air. So little sunlight ever found its way to this spot that it had an earthy, deadly smell, and so much cold wind rushed through it that it struck chill to me as if I had left the natural world. Immediately we get a sense of foreboding in the words earthy, deadly smell, struck chill to me, and as if I had left the natural world. The way the man keeps looking back to the tunnel makes the narrator suspect that the man is inhuman or a ghost, or if not, he speculates that perhaps he has mental health problems. As the narrator begins to talk to the signalman, he realises that the man is afraid of him. The man seems to have a dread of him and confesses he thought he had seen him before at the entrance of the tunnel. After some chat in the signal box, in which the narrator comes to find out more about the man's life and duties, which include attending to a little bell that rings when messages are telegraphed through, he notices that the man is disturbed several times when the bell does not ring. The troubled signalman promises to tell the narrator more if he comes the next evening. Showing the narrator out, he makes a strange request. "I'll show my white light, sir," he said in his peculiar low voice, "till you have found the way up. When you have found it, don't call out. And when you're at the top, don't call out." His manner seemed to make the place strike colder to me, but I said no more than, "Very well. And when you come tomorrow night, don't call out. Let me ask you a parting question. What made you cry, 'Hello, below there,' tonight?" "Heaven knows," said I. "I cried something to that effect." "Not to that effect, sir. Those were the very words. I know them well." "Admit those were the very words. I said them, no doubt, because I saw you below. For no other reason. What other reason could I possibly have?" "You had no feeling that they were conveyed to you in any supernatural way?" "No." and with this puzzle, the narrator leaves the signalman. The next night, the signalman tells his tragic story, but first, he confesses again that he had mistaken the narrator for someone else the night before. The narrator asks who it is. "Like me?" he questions. "I don't know. I never saw the face. The left arm is across the face and the right arm is waved, violently waved, this way." I followed his action with my eyes, and it was the action of an arm, gesticulating with the utmost passion and vehemence. "For God's sake, clear the way!" Note here that the signalman imitates the action and speech he has seen both the narrator and the spectre perform. The narrator mentally adds a piece of speech which the signalman does not say. It's more difficult to hear this, but easier on the page. The extra speech is, "For God's sake, clear the way!" The signalman tells the narrator that one night he saw a man doing this gesture and shouting the same phrase of, "Hello, below there, look out, look out!" But when he got close, the man was gone. The signalman then telegraphs his warning up and down the line, but is told not to worry. All is well. The narrator soothes him and says that it was probably just the wind in the wires. "No," the signalman says. 10 hours later, a terrible accident left many dead and injured. A coincidence, the narrator reassures him, but feels a disagreeable shudder. Again, the signalman says that this is not the end of this. 7 months later, he saw the spectre again. This time it was not waving or shouting, but was silent, its hands covering its face in an action of mourning. That same day, the signalman says he saw some commotion in a carriage and tried to warn the driver. But too late, a woman had died. Following this, the signalman sees the spectre repeatedly and he is beginning to lose his mind. If it's a warning, he should tell someone, but if it's a false alarm, he should lose his job. The narrator leaves for the second time, even more troubled, as now he has the burden of responsibility upon him, as he is convinced the signalman is not fit for duty, but does not want to report him to his superiors. Resolved to return the next day and persuade the man to see a doctor, he leaves at 2 in the morning. The next evening, he sets out for a walk before visiting the signalman. "Before pursuing my stroll, I stepped to the brink and mechanically looked down from the point from which I had first seen him. I cannot describe the thrill that seized upon me when, close at the mouth of the tunnel, I saw the appearance of a man with his left sleeve across his eyes, passionately waving his right arm. At first he thinks it is a spectre, and then realising it's a man, and that there are other men too, the first man is rehearsing the gesture to the others. In terms of foreshadowing, the repetition of that action accumulates like a snowball, gathering significance as it moves towards the inevitable ending. The narrator descends the path to be told that the signalman has been killed. The engine man tells the narrator how he saw the signalman with his back to the tunnel. There was no time to brake, so the driver shouted out, "Below there, look out, for God's sake, clear the way!" At this, the narrator gives a start. The driver goes on, "Oh, it was a terrible time, sir. I never left off calling to him. I put this arm before my eyes not to see, and I waved this arm to the last..." But it was no use. So, the gesture and the words have been fulfilled, all foreshadowing the death of the signalman. However, that is not the strangest or most chilling part of this story. Listen to the conclusion told by the narrator. "Without prolonging the narrative to dwell on any one of its curious circumstances more than on any other, I may, in closing it, point out the coincidence that the warning of the engine driver included not only the words which the unfortunate signalman had repeated to me as haunting him, but also the words which I myself, not he, had attached, and that only in my own mind, to the gesticulation he had imitated." The engine driver's final statement, "For God's sake, clear the way!" was never spoken by the signalman. It only came into the thoughts of the narrator. The reader begins to question whether the narrator is in fact himself the spectre. This has been hinted at from the start. The ending is uncertain and unresolved and sends the reader back to the beginning to read the clues again. However, there is no doubt that the story contains almost an excess of foreshadowing, contributing to the uncanny and disturbing effect on the reader. Foreshadowing then can be subtle or direct. It can predict events to come, or it can direct mood and atmosphere through symbolism, imagery and metaphor. One thing is guaranteed though, if you as a writer use it carefully, your readers will be turning the pages.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, that was fascinating.
Wow. Yeah.
Very informative.
Yes, very informative.
That's very good. I think I need to keep that in mind with Mary Magdalene. Yeah. I don't think I have much foreshadowing, if any.
Yeah.
I haven't been putting a lot of thought.
I certainly haven't been conscious about it, but it's maybe...
I think a lot of us do it naturally.
We do it unconsciously, you know, like... the tip I got from Nicola when she was saying you must have your villain appear in the first scene and everything. And I thought, it's not in the first chapter in my case, but I did have the one-eyed woman is...
When I came to edit this episode, I found the last 2 or 3 minutes missing. As we'd all gone our separate ways, it wasn't possible to get back in the studio. So I asked Heather, who's in Buxton, and Alison, who's in Manchester, to record themselves talking about their bedside table books. They've very kindly done that and emailed me the files. So, with apologies for the patchwork nature of the end of this podcast, let's hear from Heather and Alison.
I'm currently reading Mythos, The Greek Myths Retold by Stephen Fry. Not about beer, as one might imagine, coming from me. The Greek myths are the greatest stories ever told, passed down through millennia and inspiring writers and artists as varied as Shakespeare, Michelangelo, James Joyce and Walt Disney. They are embedded deeply in the traditions, tales and cultural DNA of the West. In Stephen Fry's hands, the stories of the Titans and gods become a brilliantly entertaining account of ribaldry and revelry, warfare and worship, debauchery, love affairs and life lessons, slayings and suicides, triumphs and tragedies. You'll fall in love with Zeus, marvel at the birth of Athena, wince at Cronus and Gaia's revenge on Uranus, weep with King Midas and hunt with the beautiful and ferocious Artemis. Thoroughly spellbinding, informative and moving, Stephen Fry's mythos perfectly captures these stories for the modern age in all their rich and deeply human relevance, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I found it a little hard going at first, and the lists of names and places a little bit tedious, but once I got into it, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Can't wait to carry on reading.
My book at bedtime is The Passengers by John Mars. This is the second novel by John Mars I've read, and already he's becoming a bit of a favourite with me. You know that thrill when you find a new author, and now you can work right way through their whole back catalogue. That's how I'm feeling about John Mars right now. The Passengers is in the vein of the Charlie Brooker series Black Mirror. It's set in the future when driverless cars are not only available, but compulsory. Through incentives and other economic factors, society has swiftly moved from semi-controlled vehicles to those in which artificial intelligence makes all decisions. The book begins with a narrative of 6 drivers who get in their cars to set off for various destinations. We learn a little about their characters as they do. Claire is a pregnant woman, Jude a handsome single man down on his luck, Sophia an ageing actress. Sam and Heidi Cole in separate cars are parents of 2 children celebrating their 10th wedding anniversary. Shabana, a Bengali woman, is escaping a brutal marriage. Later, they're joined by Bilquis Hamila, a Somalian refugee, and Victor Patterson, an ageing war veteran. They are in the wrong taxi at the wrong time. As each character's journey gets underway, they hear a voice telling them they have been rerouted and are on their way to their deaths, which will take place in just over 2 hours. Vainly, each tries to take control of the cars, but the car's AI has been hacked and they are unable to override it. Meanwhile, Libby Dixon is on her way to serve on a vehicle inquest jury. It seems that accidents still happen with driverless cars, but the juries that decide whether liability is held by the AI companies, the car manufacturers, or the victims are held in strict secret. The victims are nearly always held to blame, and the courts find in favour of the driverless car companies. Libby is surprised to be chosen for jury service, as an incident in her life has led her to hate driverless cars, and she's become a campaigner against them. Nevertheless, she's unable to get out of her duty, and when she arrives, she is treated with contempt by a few other members of the jury, and chiefly by the arrogant MP and Cabinet Minister Jack Larson. It seems her attendance is solely to fulfil a requirement for there to be a member of public, but once the case is underway, it appears that she's been chosen for more sinister reasons. Without giving away what happens next, the carjacking of the driverless vehicles and the tribunal are brought together. One of the passengers can be saved, and the jury, and then the wider public, will have to decide who. It's a kind of global balloon debate aired on social media. Who should be saved and why? There are some real moral questions at the heart of this novel, as the jury, social media, and of course you, the reader, make decisions on who to save and who to condemn to death. The arguments reveal the prejudices that drive decision-making. The way social media opinion is stoked by emotion, shallow thinking and fickle likes and dislikes is brought into sharp relief when we learn more facts about each passenger. These revelations pull the rug from under the jury, public and reader, as we are shown how limited information leads to bad decision-making. Both AI and human judgment is shown to be deeply flawed. Eventually, we find out who is behind the hacking, and this exposes all sorts of corruption, greed and deception. It's a cracking read, and one which will stay with me quite a while.
So here I am, sitting alone, recording the close of the podcast. Thank you for your patience. Join us over on Facebook to continue the conversation. Normal levels of amateurism and incompetence will be restored next week. Bye!